Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Evangelical Dark Web. Tonight, we're going to have a very controversial conversation, I guess. This week, me and Joel Webbin are in a conversation or competition to see who can be the most controversial with Joel, you know, mean tweets to a certain feminist figure, and then me going after Dietrich Bonhoeffer. And, you know, who's going to be the most controversial? Well, I brought in Wesley Todd, who, if you're familiar with Joel Webbin, you know who he is. He's kind of like the brains over there, and he's going to help me be more controversial than Joel Webbin tonight, I guess. So
that's a tall task, I'll tell you what.
All right, but you know, we're going to talk about the Bible, kind of how race is defined in the Bible, and we're also going to discuss physiognomy and whether there's a scientific or spiritual reality at play there as well, because they did a live stream, or maybe it was not live, but pre-recorded some sort of episode on race and genetics and, you know, traits being passed down and talking about how grace transforms nature. And I believe that there's a lot to build on with that conversation that I believe adults and Christians can have. So let's have some fun conversations tonight. So how are you doing?
I'm doing good. It was great. I met you at the Right Response conference here over the weekend. So it was great to meet in person. And exactly like you said, we talked about it a couple weeks ago. And I'll say that our angle there was definitely on the way that you live. There's this kind of Gnostic view that you could say, well, we live and we have the body, but that would be, you know, nothing dissimilar to a cardboard box that kind of houses the real item of value, which is the soul. And you can put tattoos on the box, you can color it up, it could be white, it could be black, none of it matters, because really what is passed along is the soul, the spirit. That's what matters, our eternal state. What we really wanted to push across in the episode is to say, no, like your children, your grandchildren, your great-grandchildren, they're going to actually bear some of the impact of how you live. I think of Jesus, how he says that which is done in secret will be shouted from the rooftops. And so nobody gets away with anything. And so that was kind of the thrust of that episode. But really with this topic, there's so much more to talk about. I'll just give a little bit of my bona fides here at the beginning, just to say why I know what I'm talking about. So I have my undergraduate degree from Columbia University in neuroscience and behavior. So I did biology, I'd done chemistry, and I also have my master's degree in public health. So I've gone through on the academic side, studied the stuff academically, very familiar with it. Obviously, any topic you can go on and you could do a whole PhD in, be it DNA, be it traits, be it genetics, all of that. But very familiar broadly with the topic, done a lot of reading, done a lot of studying on my own. And so that's why I feel qualified to talk about it to the degree that I do.
Awesome. So we're going to continue that conversation, because I'm not overly a science guy. Like, I understand basic science. I apparently understood virology more than the nation's top experts. And I probably understand climate science more than the top experts, just because I can kind of learn that, but also put it together with other sciences, which I don't think
the science of common sense, you know?
Yeah.
And common sense tells me, yeah, this is not going to overheat the earth.
Right. Or that rising sea levels actually cools the earth. So it's a homeostasis effect. They don't tell you that.
Funny how that works.
But anyway, or that it's good because of historically speaking, warmer climate is good. So they don't tell you that. They don't mix, you know, they kind of operate in their silos and they don't mix. Although with certain virology, they kind of just ignore the science and the history in their own field. So with that said, let's dive into that. And I just want to say, I guess the opening is, what are your thoughts on the difference between culture and race? And that's kind of been something that's big in the news lately because of a certain high profile homicide incident in, I believe, Frisco, Texas.
Right.
So yeah. Some people are saying it's, you know, 100% race. Some people are saying it's only culture. I got to say, though, if, you know, child of mine died in a Boondocks episode incident, you know, I don't think it would just be the culture. Like, I don't know.
Just trained wrong, you know?
Yeah, I don't really think that's 100% it. But obviously, I don't think that genetics are deterministic of behavior and outcomes. So what are your kind of thoughts on delineating race and culture?
Before we go ahead and
defining race on a biblical level.
Absolutely. So let's start with just definitions of what is, when I say race, what do I mean? Our word in English comes from the French word, and it carries with it a connotation of kin, kind, lineage, and likeness. The tricky thing about language, the other Paula said this, and I think it's really insightful, language is not mechanical in the way that physics or math is. Language is contextual. So if I use the word race, you would also have, for example, John Calvin would use the word race. We might not necessarily be saying the same thing. So even though he's using a word, he's in a context, in a time where that could have much more connotation that has to do with, like I said, kin and lineage. But I could say it today and use it with someone, and they would understand race to be something like skin color. That's what they would understand it to mean. And so when I talk about race, I'm going to have to just say, I understand there's different definitions of it. Same thing with ethnicity. I understand there's different ways to talk about it. You could frame it in this way. You could simplify it. You could pack all of this meaning into it. But for my purposes, when I talk about race, what I'm talking about is biology. I'm not talking about language. I'm not talking about music. I'm not talking about morals. I'm talking about the biological stratum, the genetics that you get, and you get them because you're descended from certain people and not others. So if we're talking about lineage, we're talking about genetics, we're talking about a common ancestry, that you share an ancestor with a number of different people, and those people are distinct from other peoples that had different ancestors. To just really exemplify the point, many people in India descended from an ancestor, now all of us from Adam. So at the very core of it, you have Adam and Eve, the father and the mother of all that is living. But going out from it, you had, for example, Noah's sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Ham going south, Canaan going south, that Africa region. Shem expanding out generally to the east, Japheth generally to the north. Well, if you're a European, that means you don't share an ancestor. There's nobody related to you, depending on the individual circumstances of your family, until you get all the way back to Noah. And that means for about 2,000, 3,000 years, there's been a context of environment. There's been context of wars, of famine, of disease, context of religion. All of those have shaped, as we talked about in that episode I've talked about before, what you're bringing to the table. And it's the same thing for anyone who went east and the same thing for people that went south. They just don't share the same ancestors. None of that's bad. None of that's immoral. All we're saying with race is we recognize that things have happened and people are different. And that difference is not just culture. It's not just skin deep. There are biological differences. If you could pull up that X-ray image of a graph, I want to just show this point. So this was a study from just a couple years ago, and they went to use AI to attempt to determine ancestry. And what they even did is they went so far as to take the images and to really blur them, to take those images and say, if we remove almost any of the detail, so they're not high fidelity, they're not crisp, AI was still, with over 80% accuracy, able to determine the race of individuals from blurry, noisy, grainy images. This is looking at things like your size of your rib cage, chest expansion, bone structure. Even those things, at a black and white, grainy, blurry level, superpowered computer can look at it and say, yeah, we think this person is of Asian descent. This person is of African descent. This person is of European descent. It is a biological reality that you cannot erase. And here's the deal. If you look at it, you're like, okay, I guess that's true. Well, that's how God made the world. So we don't have to be scared about talking about race. Now, race isn't the only thing. I'll get to ethnicity here in a minute. But when I'm talking about race, when I'm speaking on it, my definition that I'm using, I know other people have different definitions, and I know there's things that you can do with it. But what I'm talking about is biology, genetics, everything about you, not cultural, but deep down that makes you who you are.
So along those lines, why wouldn't it be helpful to say, you know, one race, a human race, even though we all share, you know, because we all share the common ancestor of Adam? Why wouldn't that be helpful then? Or why can't Christians? What?
I can't take bone marrow from a black man.
You can't?
There's different within bone marrow. There's a number, it's 10 different factors that have to be considered. And if you don't share them, my body would actually reject it. So I get what you're saying. Like, some people will say, well, it's messy to talk about race. People have done bad things before. And so what we're going to do is one race, the human race. And I understand that. But if you did that, like organ transplants and bone marrow and other things like that, they're just fundamentally incompatible. We have to recognize that, yes, within the human biodiversity realm, God has made differences. And I actually think that's for the better. How boring would the world be if you could think about it this way? If God just made human beings and every human being fit everywhere on earth in his language, his customs, we all kind of ate the same thing. We all had the same preferences. Every man had a preference for the same type of woman. That would be a flat, boring, bland world. It just really would be. It would be a world of widgets and robots. But God didn't make that. He said, I'm going to make people that look different, people that act different, people that have different preferences. They're going to be shaped and molded by their context and their environment. They're going to be different. And in the final day, I'm going to bring them together and I'm going to have to save people out of this race and people out of that race and people out of that family. And they're all going to gather together and they're going to glorify me as God. And they're ultimately going to say, God, you're glorious, and it's glorious because your creation was not just this simple brown goo. It's diverse, it's beautiful, it's multifaceted, it's manifest with different languages and different songs and different churches and different histories. All of those people are going to praise God. And I think that's an awesome design. So I'm not going to come here and say, well, there's just one group of people worshiping God in heaven, the human race. No, there's going to be Russians and there's going to be Americans and there's going to be Mexicans, all of them together praising him. And it's going to be an incredible testament to God's wisdom, his awe, his might, and his power, to his glory forever and ever.
Awesome. I almost want to say, it sounds like you're saying that diversity is our strength.
In a way, yes. And in a way, no. Yep.
Yeah.
So let's move on then. I was going to say to ethnicity.
Okay. What? So you're using race and ethnicity differently. So how are you doing that?
Yep. So I would distinguish the two. So race is biology and genetic. Say you could know everything about me as far as materialistically, right? You could look at my brain structure and you could see my testosterone and my bone structure. You could look at all of that and wouldn't tell you what language I speak. For instance, faith is not a gland, it's not a muscle, it's not an organ. You wouldn't be able to know my religion. And so we recognize, as I just kind of pointed out and made the case for, there's that biological reality. But then there's, and I wouldn't necessarily call all of it spirit, but there's what makes people people. It's their history, for example. Again, just looking at someone biologically, you could know everything about their cells. You wouldn't be able to tell their history. You wouldn't be able to tell what stories animate them. And so you have race, but then you have ethnicity. And ethnicity, Stephen Wolf says it this way. He said it's something that's experienced. So it's not something that I can necessarily scientifically evaluate, but it's something that we experience. America is an ethnicity. It's a series of stories. It's a history. It's an ethos. In some ways, it's a myth. It's the myth of the founding that we tell ourselves, not because it's false or untrue, but it's the story that we bring together out of the facts. And so we have an American ethos, an American myth, an American story. We have American holidays. We have an American language. If I talk about Memorial Day to a European, they're going to be like, what are you talking about? They're not going to know that. They're not going to have the same preferences for food that I have. And so every ethnicity then sits atop of, a way you could think of it, sits atop of race. Just because I know someone is Black doesn't tell me if they're Haitian or Nigerian. Now that, here's what people will do. They'll say, all right, great, biology, genetics, all of that, and ethnicity. And they'll be like, ethnicity is the only thing that matters. And what they'll do is they'll get really fast and loose with what can belong to an ethnicity. So, you know, if you go to Mexico and you celebrate Day of the Dead, I don't even know, eat tacos and enjoy Corona. These are all American things anyway. But if you do that, then you could be part of the Mexican ethnos, the Mexican people. And I'll say, no, you can't. Because race and ethnicity, this is what a lot of people, they don't want to do, and it's tough to recognize, they're intimately intertwined. So because of people are a certain way, that's going to actually drive how they live. A great example would be, for example, the Germans versus the Italians. Generally speaking, the Germans, the Germanic tribes, were a farming people. So that would mean they were more spaced out. They didn't gather in cities as much. And they worked the land. They had a connection to the land. Italians were a city people. They lived in city states. And so when the Italians came over here, for example, in the 1920s, when immigration was really unfettered, especially from Sicily, the Italians didn't come and go to the Midwest in the bread bowl and start farms. They came to New York City and they started the mafia because they were city people. And the German.
I do got to say, I recently was learning more about my heritage, and yeah, you're kind of describing my heritage here, because that's, you know, funny. My father's line is Italian, and you know, we immigrated sometime in like the 1890s. There's a bit of a 30-year gap that's kind of a little lost, but yep. Yeah, you know, John Harris was saying at the conference something about how many generations removed from the family farm you are. But if you're Italian, the question is how many generations removed from the mafia are you? So anyway, yep. For me, the answer is about two.
Right. Okay. We can work on those numbers. We can work on that. and all that to say, I could totally have an Italian here and him be like, I live out in 10 acres on the farm. You've got to get this in your brain, dear listener. The average is different from the individual, right? Men are taller than women. Well, I know a woman that's taller than me on average. So I'm speaking on averages about these people groups. On average, the Germanic peoples were more of a country-dwelling people. On average, the Italians were more of a city-dwelling people, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so all that being said, some people like to try to bifurcate them. Like, well, yeah, you have skin color. Yeah, you have biology. Yeah, you have genetics. But then what really matters, like we're talking about with the stabbing, I think Anthony Carmelo is his name. Well, that was the culture. So the problem is nothing to do with the traits and everything that have come across and been discipled and inculcated. Nothing to do with those biological traits. It just has to do with the music they listened to, the television that they watched, the schooling. They just weren't educated. You can do all of that. But here's the deal. Why, if you take Black Americans as a whole, so they're about 13 to 15% of the population, and it would depend on the city, it would depend on the metric, it would depend on all of these, but they're about 13 to 15% of the population, but they commit about 33, the FBI averages on the low, to over 50% of violent crime. But then you go to Africa and you see the same levels of violence, of aggregated assault, of rape, and of murder. Why is it that white men commit less murder than Black women per capita? It's a fact. Ben Shapiro, facts don't care about your feelings. And so it's very easy to say, like, well, it's the culture, it's this, it's that. But here's the deal. Where does culture come from? What drives a people to behave how they behave, to prioritize what they prioritize, to value what they value? Now, certainly religion is one of those factors. So we'd never say it's raw biological determinism. It's just biology. It's just genetics. That's what drives it. It's not just that. And it's certainly not for the individual. An individual can come from a broken family, come from a violent people, and himself be upstanding. But again, speaking on the average, there is a close connection. And very often the overlap of race with ethnicity, the Venn diagram, so to speak, it's a circle. The French race also are typically French. They speak French. They eat French food. They live in France. And so ethnicity and race are very closely tied together, more so than I think some people would like to project.
Okay. So what are your thoughts on how God created the differences between different races? Because looking at genetics, I would imagine that some modification, you know, God had to have guided some modification of the human genome, and certain phenotypes emerge post Noah. So what are your thoughts on that? And, you know, is it simply where they settled, you know, were they mountain people? Did they go towards the equator and therefore more direct sunlight darkens their skin color? Is it sure. The reverse makes them paler? Like, but, and we also see like in the Bible that there's all sorts of genetic diversity with Esau being like a hairy ginger, right?
Yep.
So, you know, do you think that yeah. a lot of this is this would have to be some sort of God ordained, I don't want to say mutations, but certainly variants, right?
Yep, absolutely. You can pull up this chart. I think this is fascinating. This is the first chart that I sent you. This is a diagram of the development of haplogroups. So these are patrilineal. They only go through the father. And you can see as different ones, as they begin to mutate. So mutations and changes to them are called polymorphisms. And you see there, Africa is in orange. And what you're seeing there on the left is will be the African haplotype. And it begins to branch out. This is because, as best we can tell, the origination of the human race, speaking, well, of just human beings in general, it emerges from North Africa. And so you have people there, and this would be Ham, that generally have just lived there their entire time. So it's not like this is a people that, to get there, passed first through India and then down into Australia. That's actually where you see the most diversity. You see it typically in the Americas and Australias as people moved out, stayed for a long time, then due to war, due to change, due to climate, moved to another place at each point, picking up different pieces of the environment shaped in different ways by the experiences that they had. But all of this branches out from the middle of the Near East, where Africa, North Africa, which looked a lot different than it looks today, is where Eden and then Mount Ararat, where the human race, the human people start and begin to branch out from.
When you go back, kind of interrupt, you're saying that the Garden of Eden is closer to North Africa, or?
As best I can tell, it's somewhere in that Crescent, Levant, North African region. You think of the four rivers that it speaks of moving there. Again, how was the earth changed in the flood? How was it changed at the fall? I would never sit down and be like, yeah, within a 10 square mile, this is probably where it was. But being able to look and see that there's people that have continuously inhabited this place since really what we would call Noah, since the dawn of humans branching out and leaving. That's my best guess. Generally, North Africa, so you have people that go south, for example, compared to China. So say the Garden of Eden was in modern day China, for instance, you would have peoples as they come over to Africa, picking up what becomes Europeans, picking up what becomes Russians, all the way down to Africa, but we just don't see that. So that's my best estimate.
Okay. Somewhere I would have thought somewhere in Eastern Anatolia or something like that, but it's
generally that area.
So
we go to God's original design then. So we'll look at Adam, for instance. One of the biggest things, and this comes up again, you can put the chart away. One of the biggest things is he says you've got to spread out. Looking at different parts of Ezekiel, it's probably likely that the Garden of Eden, it's at a mountaintop, and so Adam is a type of priest, king figure. And he's told to send all of his, to go out and conquer the earth. He's to take dominion. He's to multiply.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax tip and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
If that was accomplished, there's no fall. Eve never eats of the fruit. Adam has many, many, many sons, and they go out and they tame the forest wilderness around them, returning to Eden to worship, returning to care for the garden that God has put there. If they do that, the peoples would have looked different. And this is part of God's design. So God didn't design mountains that have less oxygen, which change the adaptation of monks that live at high atmospheres and create deserts and then create forests and lakes and different things. He didn't create all of those, create their effect that they would have on the human genome, but then expect millions and millions, billions and billions of people to spread out, to occupy the earth, and for none of it to change them at all. Adam's ancestors, the ones that lived farther away in different higher climates that ate a different diet, I genuinely think would have looked different from the ones that perhaps dwelt in lowlands that dwelt near sea level, that lived near the coast. They would have eaten different food. They would have cared and caught their food different ways. They would have just looked different. And all this is pre-sin. So pre-sin, you would have still, I believe, had races of people, common ancestors from Adam's first son, common ancestors from Adam's 51st son, all these common ancestries, again, coming back, even as it still is today, to Adam and Eve, but they're spread out and they looked and they act and they are different. So the fall happens, as we know, and you get to Noah. And Noah's bringing along him and his sons, their three wives, eight people total in the ark. They're bringing together some level of biodiversity. So now we're not talking Adam and Eve, a perfect man and a perfect woman genetically. This is actually why, like, Adam's sons and daughters were able to marry each other. There hadn't been genetic mutations that, for example, this is why incest is morally wrong and genetically wrong. If they come together, they actually, they're both carriers for the disease. Recessively, they would pass it on to their children and they have terrible health outcomes. But you don't have that in Adam's sons and daughters. But then you get to Noah's sons and you get to Noah's, the wives of Noah's sons, and he has the three of them. And already there's some difference. So Ham's sin is a sin of impulse. For example, there's some readings, and I think it might be true, that what Adam does is not just look at Noah naked. The interpretation would be that he slept actually with Noah's wife, that Ham was an impulsive man, and Noah passed out, asleep, drunk, that in that, Ham uncovered his nakedness, not Noah's nakedness, but the nakedness and shame of his wife. And that's why Noah is so furious. Again, I'm not going to die on that hill necessarily, but I think that's one interpretation. So you have Ham, who has less impulse control. He's probably maybe bigger and stronger. And then Ham goes out and is the father of Canaan and other sons, says Genesis 10, the table of nations. And those sons, on average, are going to carry across traits and differences from his brothers. These are the descendants of Ham, NFL cornerbacks.
And specifically, Canaan is most cursed among the, the curse of Ham is really, yes, the curse of Canaan. But along those lines, I kind of want to pause at Ham for a second. What are your thoughts on, obviously there's the Nephilim giants were being wiped out, but what are your thoughts on the fact that, or the theory that Ham's wife was a carrier of the giant genes that were then, I guess, concentrated to bring back the Rephaim?
I've heard that theory. Obviously, I sit, 3 feet away from Joel for 6 hours, 6 hours a week.
Okay.
I don't like the theory of fallen angels for the reason that it breaks the divide among the spiritual and the physical. Okay. Just in that, if you had immaterial angels, unless you were talking with, you had a man and you had a soul and an angel inhabiting and latching onto the soul of a man and helping him to sire children. If you don't have that, then how do you have angels taking physical form and providing, as we just talked about, all of the DNA that is necessary to join to the egg and to actually create a human being? So I tend to think of them as great violent kings, that even in the story there in Genesis 6, what you have is two lines. One, you have a righteous line of strong, good, technologically advanced men. And then you have men that are dark and violent and wicked, and their daughters come into them. And what you have is the conquering of a race, a lineage, a kinship of violent, wicked men. So I don't take necessarily that view that that's Ham's wife. You mentioned Canaan as well. Some commentators, this was brought up in a debate with Chris Roseborough. Some commentators like Luther, they would take it to say the shame of Ham is so great that Noah curses Canaan in the place of Ham. And so his curse is not necessarily just to the one son of Ham. It's actually, he won't even say Ham's name. And so he curses Canaan, his son, as a stand-in for Ham. I tend to generally take that interpretation because it's Ham that commits the sin. And so it's the iniquity that flows through Ham to Canaan, to his other sons. Now, in that's not to say that all the sons of Ham forever, for all time, are cursed. But it is to say that, and God even says this, the iniquity of the fathers is visited on the children to the third and the fourth generation. So a curse is visited upon Ham, and God visits the iniquity of the fathers upon their children. And so generation upon generation upon generation of Ham's descendants have rebelled. They've worshipped demons. They've committed great violence. And so that iniquity continues to this day. Now, that can be broken. That's not to say it'll never end and there's no one doing it and no one from this line can be saved. It can be saved the same way all iniquity is saved, by the repentance and turning in faith to Jesus and the start of a new, it's almost as if an entire line of sin and iniquity and wickedness and violence, when that individual, that's the result of that, when he gets saved, and not just him, his wife gets saved and his children get saved and his grandchildren get saved. It'll take a couple generations, right? If someone's a heroin addict until they're 50 years old, they're going to live with the scars of that for their life. If someone's violent, if someone's this, that, or the other, they're probably going to have anger issues still in this life until a resurrection and a new body. But all that to say, you think about the curse of Ham, the curse of Canaan, all these different things. Most certainly, there's different ways guys have parsed it out. I tend to think Noah is cursing Ham through the stand-in of Canaan, and that iniquity, as long as it's persisted in, is continued to be visited upon the children of Ham.
Okay, since you're a line of Seth respecter, like John Calvin was, if I recall,
yep.
What are your thoughts on giants then in the Bible? So, you know, Goliath and, you know, whoever his ancestors right. might be.
Are you ready for it?
I'm ready.
If you had no morals and you took CrossFit Games, the woman that won the CrossFit Games, right? Just, I mean, that's not a, you know, like, well, we all worked hard and you worked a little bit harder. Like, just built for it. Like, fast twitch muscle fibers, slow twitch muscle fibers, skeleton structure, bone density. She's just an impressive physical specimen. If you had no morals, this is not moral, but if you did that and you took and you went to the mountain, what is he, 6'7", 6'8"?
Yeah.
The way genetics work, you would have an incredible genetic specimen.
I believe that actual mountain is going after some 5'2 chick. So, you know, he's totally failing here.
And that's in God's mercy that, you know, human mating is not just it's not a spreadsheet, that we don't do it that way, which actually in many ways contributes, because the worst would congregate with the worst and the best would congregate with the best. But in God's mercy, he's put love, he's put individuality, preferences, and all that. But all the way back to giants, what if you had no morals, you were ruled by wicked pagan kings, and the biggest, the strongest, the tallest king would take the most physically attractive, most robust woman to be his daughter, and they for generations and generations had sons and daughters. You would have, I don't know, a line of guys that are 8, 9, 10 feet tall. I understand there's passages about giants as tall as the cedar trees. I tend to think that's what we're talking about when we talk about Goliath, when we talk about these guys. I mean, 6 fingers and 6 toes, you're talking about guys pushing the edge. This is not, you know, man's 5'5", marries a 5'2" woman, out comes 7'5" and 6 fingers and 6 toes. Not so sure about this. Again, it's not a perfect system. I'm getting roasted in the chat. Come on, people, help me out. Help a materialist out here. But Line of Seth, giants, how do you get them? I think without blurring that spiritual material divide, that's my best guess.
So you think that this is like Crusader Kings 3, where you can just breed your family into being giants?
I mean, I don't want to be crass, but I mean, we can do that with dogs. Like that's what are horses and dogs, except here's the optimal pairing.
Yeah, especially since horses, you know, probably in the beginning of the Bible, you know, so in the book of Exodus, for instance, horses weren't really made for humans to just ride on. That's why they used chariots.
Right.
It's, you know, towards the end of the Bronze Age where people could ride horses because they bred horses to be big enough for human, I don't want to say consumption, but for human riding and stuff.
Yeah, so, absolutely.
Most people don't
There's
realize
research papers
that.
Out there that you could breed dogs to get them to the point where they could talk. Now, it's speculative, but they say in 100 years of intensive breeding with dogs, you're really careful about it, you could get dogs to talk. So all that being said,
have anything to say, but, you know.
That's, yeah, I love dogs, grew up with dogs, don't have any now. Maybe we'd like to hear their thoughts, maybe not. But the point being, is it possible that we are just talking about kind of the edges of a pagan, wicked society and what they're willing to do with their offspring? Possibly. And I saw someone in the chat, they're like, what about divine counsel? I believe in the divine counsel, Psalm 82:1. I'm there for it. I'm just not there for angels providing 23 chromosomes, all of that, all of the DNA, RNA polymerase. I'm just not down with angels somehow cooking that up and daughters of men and all of that. I can't do it.
All right. So I got a sidetracked on giants and
what else? No, that's great.
So I guess I want to go back to the table of nations because I'm always fascinated by that. What would you say that the, I don't want to just single out the Chinese or Japanese, but what do you say?
Sure.
Where do they fall in, under the three nations of, or Japheth, Ham, and Shem? Where do you say they come from? I've seen maps say different things.
I've seen maps say different things too. Some Japheth heading to the north. It seems to be in that parallel. So God will enlarge Japheth. He will dwell in the tents of Shem. Abraham comes from Shem's line, and then Ham or Canaan will be his servant. I generally understood that, and others do this as well, that Japheth would be the European race, which God enlarged, the first Christendom, that the Japheth then, the tents of Shem, would be the spiritual tents of Abraham. So it's not necessarily saying that Japheth will be enlarged, and then, but even he will come and pay tribute to the Chinese, the Russians. But it's talking about the spiritual tents, the inheritance of Abraham, and then Canaan will be his servant. So I don't think we have anything specific there as far as kind of a deterministic Eastern perspective. If I had to guess, you could maybe even pull up that haplochart again. It might show. If I had to guess, we're probably looking at probably an admixture. That's what makes all of this so difficult. I would never want to kind of present. So you have it about halfway through there. I would never want to present any of this as an exact science that I can exactly pull from someone all of their information. I can trace them directly. People intermarry, people change. And so when you look at the Chinese people and those generally just in the Eastern part of the world, not quite clear where they came from. Same thing for Ashkenazi Jews that emerged in 600 to 800s in Germany. It's not really clear where they came from. It was a small roving band of individuals. And so there are just some questions that have been lost to time.
Yeah. And I guess the same question would apply to Native Americans, but I guess the same answer as well. But that was debated historically, is like, where did they come from? And people kind of used the inability to determine where they come from to deny humanity. But even the Pope, I believe, put the kibosh on that. So.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. So Table of Nations, I'm going to read from, this is actually jumping ahead into the New Testament. So Acts 17, 26 and 27. This is pretty common verse. I would think a lot of your listeners have heard it. But it says this, God hath made of one blood, this is one human race, it's not literally false, but it's just maybe a little bit too simplistic. God hath made of one blood all nations of men for to dwell on the face of the earth, and hath determined the times before appointed and the bounds of their habitation that they should seek the Lord. One of the questions that exists is, what is a nation for sure? And are nations coterminous with race? So when we speak of nation, are we really just speaking of an enlarged family? And there certainly is a sense in which the Bible kind of speaks that way. So it says there in Acts that God, from one man, from Adam, he fills the earth with nations, and then he establishes the bounds of their habitation. And I would think those bounds of those habitation are literal bounds. They're mountain ranges, they're oceans, they're rivers, they're impassable deserts. So God spreads these people out across the earth in his goodwill, and then says, you're going to be here. And you're going to be here because there's literally thousands of miles of ocean surrounding you. And you are going to be here up against this mountain range, commanding all of them, of course, to seek the Lord. But generally speaking, in that plan, nations remain distinct. They're a distinct group of peoples. They're not trying to bulldoze the mountains so that they can just be one with those that are on the other side. Same thing with oceans, all of that. And he does that, again, like we got back to and talked to earlier, he does that so that you would have individual peoples. You would have different languages and cultures and customs oriented towards worship of God. And so why did he make nations? My co-host Michael Belch has written a great book, In Defense of Christian Nations. And in that book, he says, look, Why did God gather people together? Why did he gather together these families with common ancestry in a distinct place? What are they? Why did he do it? Well, he did it to glorify himself and to be the tool of taking dominion. A nation can subdue an entire land. Like, this American continent was subdued by the American people. And they took this vast wilderness. I would call it inhabited by demons. Like, you think about the old, what are some of the old ones? Like, not a werewolf, but the skinwalkers. Okay. I think that was a real demon. Like, I don't think these hunters, the Native Americans, they're looking out and they see this 8 foot tall, lanky, shrieking apparatus. And they're like, grizzly bear. Or they see a grizzly bear and they think it's this 8 foot tall skinwalker. There was real demons in this land. The Europeans came over and they said, not on our watch. And we conquered it. And they did that as a nation. It wasn't just individual families chopping down trees. No, nations are the tools that God uses to take dominion, to be fruitful, to multiply, and to fill the earth.
All right. Let's see.
Andrew Cox, I might hit this question quick. Andrew Cox asked a good question. Would y'all say there are three races based on Noah's sons and many ethnicities inside of each race? That is one, I would say that is one way to speak of it. The thing with race, and this is why, like, I don't want anything I say. There's tons of people that could say it differently or frame it or define it differently. You could certainly say three common ancestors, Noah's sons. But here's the deal. There's also differential common ancestors between the English and the German. So are they two races? Well, I would say so. German race, the English race, the Indian race, the Nigerian race. So we can get very granular. We can get all the way down to, like, even in America. They're not really America. We're still finding ourselves. But there's a Irish Appalachian race of people with a distinct ethnos, a distinct common origin. Like, could we say that's a race? I think so. I think it's distinct from the Italians, distinct from the Germans. Eventually, we'll have, in many ways, I think, our own American race. Now, could you go all the way back to Noah and say there's three races and many ethnicities within them? I think you could, but even within that, like, there's just bone marrow that I can't take because people had different common ancestry than me. Even in, I would say, within my race, that there would be Russians or Scandinavians, I just wouldn't be compatible with. And so a little bit simplistic, not totally off the mark, but I see what he's getting at.
All right. And if you have questions, you know, someone asked if Germans are the descendants of Atlanteans. I don't know if you have any theories about Atlantis. Might be a prototypical story of the Garden of Eden, or maybe it's a pre-flood story. Who knows?
That's a Joel Levin question right there. you have to ask him.
Yeah, because I guess Joel dives more into theories, and you do the reading. So
I do the reading, and I have fun with the schizo theories, but and I'm becoming less of this. Like, I was just telling you before we hopped on, we're doing an episode next week with Ben Garrett that I think will be really good on spirit and where do we get our souls from. But I'm through and through a materialist because there's just a lot of things that are explained by material. Like, that's how God chose to make the world. He didn't choose to make, you know, just kind of the shell of a body.
When you say material, I don't want to say materialist. You're talking more about being not the opposite of Gnostic in a way.
Yes. Just attributing a lot of what we understand to materialistic things. Like, for example, you could have I was attracted to my spouse because I remember it was Megan Fox who said this years ago, Machine Gun Kelly. She's like, well, we were twin souls started at birth. That's a spiritual way of defining attraction, right? So we're attracted to each other because we're similar astrological signs, we're twin flames lost at birth. You have all of that, and obviously that's a little bit extreme, but I'm making the point. And then you have, like, well, there are just, there are subtle cues of facial symmetry that determine people's attractiveness. So you could look at a man or look at a woman and judge their attractiveness. And you're not sitting there computing, like, well, we have a planar tilt on their nose and a little bit their eye, the actual eye slant can actually affect it. You're not doing that. You're just able to take it all in, but that's still physical. All of those different things you're integrating in real time, and physical attraction is a property of those things. It's not about spiritual, this, that, or the other. So when I say materialist, that's my bent, because I just understand how a lot of different things, they're physical things, they're things we can measure, things we can touch, they're tangible. And I've typically relied on those as a heuristic to make a judgment. Why we trust people, why we're attracted to people, why we believe the things that we believe, all of that. So, but then there is a real spiritual side. So I don't say all of that to say that nothing happens on the spiritual. There is a real one. And if Joel talks about that, then you have, you know, me on the biology side. We come together. It's a great combination.
All right. Jeremy with the big brain question. He compliments your depth of knowledge. And he asks, would you say the difference between biological determinist and Wolfian ethnicity comes from different sources or different methodology? I can't really.
It's a good question. It was great having, I got to meet Jeremy this weekend. Great brother, really great guy. So would you say the difference between biological determinists and Wolfian ethnicity comes from different sources? So biological determinists, what he's kind of saying there is, there's just, if you're a member of a certain race and this race acts this way, very typically that's going to be deterministic of your outcome. If you're, for example, if your IQ is a certain measure, like you're not going to do good at school, you're going to have inclination to criminality. That would be kind of, unless Jeremy is thinking of it a different way, your biological determinism. Biological traits, very deterministic of life outcomes. Wolfian ethnicity is what I'm kind of talking about here, that you have the biology and then you have the ethnicity. And so he's asking, are those kind of, why does one arrive at the biology side? And then why does Wolf speak more necessarily of tradition, culture, heritage, calendar, language, religion, etc.? I do think they are two different sources. And I don't know that they're contradictory. So I don't know that they truly cannot dwell together. Because what Wolf is emphasizing, and I think he's right to do it, like you got to remember, Wolf is a PhD in American history, and he spent his life dedicated not to the mechanical things that made America America, but our ethos, our love for life, our what makes us American. He's dedicated his whole life to that. And so he really says, hey, at the end of the day, American is not something that I can put in a test tube. But then at the same time, the biological determinist, I understand where they're coming from, because they say, just like I said to you, you know, Black women commit murder at higher rates per capita than white men. Women committing higher crime levels. And why is that? It has some of its sources in biology, testosterone, aggression, impulse control, all of these different things. So both are emphasizing from different sources, again, one of them being in American history, American ethos, our founding, our story, what makes us who we are, not at a biological level, but at a story level, myth, spirit. And then someone saying, and here's also what makes us who we are, where we come from. And so they are different sources looking from different perspectives. I don't think they have to. Obviously, the determinist is going to try to explain everything. But generally speaking, I don't think they're necessarily contradictory. You need both. You need to say, like, no, but biology matters. Like, it, like Japan is incredibly safe. Tokyo is like the biggest city in the world, incredibly safe. And 97% Japanese, 2% other Asian ethnicities. That's biology. They're related to one another. They've done life. They've inhabited that land. And they're really, really safe. Like, it's not like, oh, well, we just need to tell the stories that the Japanese are telling. Well, we need their religion. Well, they're not Christian. They have strong rule of law, strong honor culture, and they all look like one another. So, two sides of the same coin. Which one is the most? Yeah.
All right. Parse that out. The next thing that I wanted to kind of talk about is the topic of physiognomy. And, you know, it's most evident in things like pride parades or libs of TikTok. You know, You can look at someone and tell that they are a liberal. Or even at the Right Response Conference, Crisis King, How to Defeat Trash World, you saw a lot of the people there were more or less in shape. Like, it's kind of interesting. Like, you didn't really see any people. You know, 1,000 people there, maybe 2 people there were like, wow, you're a big guy, like in a wide sort of way. you know, so no one really there was land whales or anything like that. And generally, like, even Steve Dace was skinnier in person. You know, so so even him, who, you know, used to be like 400 pounds, you know, he's lost a lot of weight.
Yeah.
He's doing it. And I got to say, yep, like, you know, this experience, physiognomy, has a lot of legitimacy to it. And I don't know whether it's a chicken or egg, because I guess I'll ask the David French paradox, because, you know, David French is someone who, you know, has gone really liberal, but he also sounds like he's taking estrogen. So, you know, I kind of want to know your thoughts. And there's also like the Mark Zuckerberg, you know, starts working out, and all of a sudden, I wouldn't say he's right wing, but he's not as left wing as he used to be.
Sure.
So, you know, do you think there's a relationship between things like testosterone and political views, for instance? Or do you think there's certain material reasons, in addition to spiritual reasons, for people's political leanings? So,
yeah, it's been said politics is biology, not to be a determinist, but like Kamala Harris, like 92% of Black women voted for her, 80% of American Jews, and then the majority, I forget what percentage, of the LGBTQ community. Those are biological categories. You know, it's not like, well, 45% of pop listeners are like, no, we're talking about different races and groups of people. And then getting to the appearance side, more and more, Roger Scruton has written about this. Beauty is a moral category. Beauty is a moral category. The implications of that, they really are profound. So I mentioned earlier, like facial attractiveness. Like facial attractiveness, they're incredible cues for, really for health, to be honest. Like facial symmetry, it's a product of in utero development. How many nutrients you got? It's a product of the genetics, like we've talked about before, your parents and your grandparents. It's a product of your diet and your nutrition. You take a man that, I could do this. I could take a man, you get him out in the sun, you get him some lifting weights, and honestly, you get him eating a reasonably good diet. Generally speaking, on average, his skin is going to look healthier. He's going to have, so your skin, if you could tell those people maybe that are overweight or out of shape, their skin has a slackness to it because the collagen in it is not as tight. His skin is going to be healthier. His skin is going to be tighter. And what's this, that's going to translate to, he's going to be more confident. Even in body posture, there's studies about this, that power poses, for instance, say you're going into a meeting, standing up, putting your shoulders back, filling up the room. You know who, people that are insecure try to take up as least space as possible. They don't speak up. They don't stand tall. They don't put themselves in the center of the room. They hunch. They stay quiet. They're timid about entering the conversation. And so it'd be very hard for me to pinpoint, you know, exactly what this looks like, exactly what's driving it. Well, leftists look like they look like because X, Y, and Z. It's not just one factor. But when you take a lifestyle on the whole, if you take a man and it's a man that's self-controlled, you take a man and it's a man that's getting outside and he's engaged in his work. So he's not just sitting there doing PowerPoints, hoping just for 5 o'clock to come along. He's winning at life. For one, that's going to drive biological changes. Winning at life increases your testosterone and increases your dopamine. So he's going to be a man that recovers better, has more libido, gets better sleep. So he wins at life. He's doing something he loves. He's physically active. That's then going to translate into better focus, better drive, better ambition, better recovery, all of that. And so, well, what do you come away with? Well, you come away with a guy that looks great, like, to be honest. And of course, not everyone's going to look the same and all of that. Same thing for a woman. She's a woman that's taking SSRIs. She's taking birth control. She's drinking a bottle of wine every weekend. You're going to get someone that looks haggard. Their skin doesn't look youthful. Like, these are just things that we know. They're reality. There's no denying it. It's just how God made the world. And so when it comes to appearance, like it's funny, you know, like Samuel says, like, man looks on the outside appearance, but God looks on the heart, or God says that to Samuel. And it's like, well, why does man look on the outside appearance? Well, really, he should be peering into the heart. No, man looks on the outward appearance because that's all he has. Like, man does his best, but ultimately we can't see the soul. And so we look at the next best thing. It's not the heart. It's not the soul. We can't see that. We can see outward appearance. We can look at a man and see if he takes care of himself, see if he holds himself with pride, see if he has masculine ambition, confidence in the way he talks, the way he carries himself, the way he dresses, all of those different things. So when it comes to physiognomy, like, yeah, it's real. Now, there are just some people in God's wisdom, they're 5'5" and they have the body type of an avocado. That's just how God made them. Still though, you can dress well, you can take care of yourself, you can be clean cut, and you can be good at what you do. And then there's other people that start with a great genetic starting place, so to speak. But all that being said, you can destroy, back to physiognomy, you can destroy in a lifetime what God gives you. And you can take yourself from the vibrant, living, excited, accomplishing individual, and through sin and through immorality and through a lack of self-control, you can destroy not just the soul. So it's not like, oh, well, I destroyed the soul, but the body is still intact. No, you destroy the body too. That the corruption and wickedness and sin in your soul can't help but come out, can't help but make you look desperate, dark, lacking, no drive. Like, that's going to come out all the way back to the beginning. We don't get away with anything. So if you live that lifestyle, it's not as though, like, well, I get to keep this, right? I still can keep up the act. No, you can't. Not in the long term. You will be that type of old person that nobody wants to spend time around. And then I think of my Nana. She's going to be surrounded by kids, grandkids, and great-grandkids. She's on, like, her second great-grandkid. Great-grandkids till the end of her days. And they're going to love her. And she's going to smile. And she's going to have joy. Because she's a godly woman that loved the Lord, that lived a life of righteousness by God's grace. And it's carried out, not just in her soul, something we can't see, but at a certain point, it literally comes out in who she is.
Wow, that was a great answer, because it made me think of Amanda Bynes, who, you know, knew about the early 2000s. She starred in, like, She's the Man or whatever, that movie where, again, she was very pretty back then. And if you've seen a recent picture of her, it's like she destroyed herself. So, yeah, that was the person that came to mind as the object lesson for what you were saying. And I guess the reverse can also be true. I don't know if you have a good example of this, but of the reverse being true, where repentance kind of restores a beauty, or like if there's a high profile example of that.
I would definitely say it's one of those things, the younger, the better. But 100%, there are people, and honestly, like, wait, you mentioned it with the conference, and it's a really good example, because this is incredible how God's made the world. Women should be soft and men should be hard. And what that means by that is the man should have strength of character. He should have a hard disposition to sin and to wickedness. He should have strength, hardness. And what's funny is if a man loses control of his diet, then he will become soft. And one of the outcomes of diabetes is that he will get ED, erectile dysfunction. And so he's so soft spiritually that he loses the ability to be physically
hard
as a continuance of the spiritual sloth that's made him soft. And the same thing for then women. If a woman cultivates hardness, an edge, everything masculine, she's not going to be attractive. But the beauty of both of those is they can absolutely be undone. So there are men, and they lost control of their diet, and they ate terribly years and years and years and years. And they said, I'm done doing it. And they cultivated, and it's a real spiritual discipline. They cultivated self-discipline, and they cultivated, and now they're no longer soft. They're no longer diabetic. They're no longer, you know, have hypertension. They're no longer unable to perform. They've become what God's intended them to be, which is strong and hard. And so women should have those graces. And if if lost for a time. She goes out, she shaves her head, she dyes her hair, she gets tattoos, she takes on debt. In God's grace, at least for a time, those are able to be undone. That she can regrow her hair and she can get the tattoos removed, and that debt can be paid off either by a suitor or by herself. But at a certain point, at 50 years old, do you just wake up and change who you are? You know, does a 50-year-old be like, I've been a jerk, I'm a terrible person to be around, I'm awful with money, and I'm impulsive, and I'm going to stop all of that today? It's happened. There's probably a dozen people that's happened to. But honestly, that window closes. And then you're the 60-year-old that's sloven, disheveled, no ambition, no amount of money to speak of, even less friends than you had at 50, and then you're 70 and you're all alone. And so the point is, early on, to get a grip in it. Yes, these things, like you asked, like, they can be undone. You can go from a man that's defeated, hunched in the corner, to, you're probably not going to be Chris Hemsworth, but you can be a man that stands with confidence. That can be undone, but the sooner the better. And the less time you spend in that slothful lifestyle, the better.
Yeah, when you brought up ED, one thing that came to mind was how, haven't they done studies that talk about how pornography gives you ED in the long run?
Yep.
And a lot of that, you know, not being the master of your own domain has historically been interpreted by many Christian theologians to be effeminacy or softness, as Paul puts it in 1 Corinthians 6.
So, yeah. Kind of, because what is the man, and I'll try to be, you know, vague in case anyone in the audience has children around, but what does the man who watches pornography, like, what is he doing? He's training himself that he doesn't take a wife and sleep with her and enjoy, as Proverbs says, the wife of his youth. He's training himself to sit in the corner and behave, to be a defeated man while the actual lion conquers. And so, of course, a man like that wouldn't be able to perform, because he's a conquered, weak man. Like, that's, and that's literally, like, that's how it happens. And then, oh, what do we know? He's spiritually weak, spiritually doesn't have self-control. And then physically, that self-control actually literally manifests itself.
Well, that was really based. I'll float it to the audience to see if they have any questions to ask. So I guess we've talked about the whole, I wonder, is there any more areas of physiognomy that we can go down? Because obviously, you know, actually, you have anything on facial hair? I'm just wondering
about on that. Facial hair, it's funny, men with higher testosterone actually typically bald earlier. Like, testosterone's a lot of it is genetic. But honestly, on facial hair, it's tempting to do the universal, like, beards are always good, or clean shaven is always good.
But some people like mustaches, like Andrew Isker.
Yeah, and they're wrong, but no. Some people like even narrower mustaches. No. The Bible doesn't really seem to prescribe. You just have the law in Leviticus. I don't think the Bible prescribes. Whatever a man should be, what he should be when it comes to facial hair, I think, is well-groomed. Like, so whether he's clean-shaven and he actually takes the time and he shaves daily, or he has a beard, and, you know, he keeps it trimmed and keeps it in control. It's not, you know, like, drooping down over his lips and getting in his food. Whether a man chooses to be clean-shaven or have a beard, the virtue there isn't, well, he shaves every day, or he has the most awesome, epic beard, but is taken care of, that he cares about his appearance, how he presents himself to people. That's as much as I would be willing to say on facial hair.
Okay. Do you have any thoughts on nicotine and tobacco as it relates to either physiognomy or even the earlier conversation about long-term?
Yeah.
Genetic effects.
So nicotine is definitely very good for you. It's anti-parasitic. It's potentially anti-cancer. It helps with tumor suppression. So it's all of those things. It's an appetite suppressant, so it'll help you lose weight. Appetite suppressant, anti-parasitic. It also is helpful for focus. And so, I mean, I have a book on my shelf. It's called Cigarette Century. Nicotine and coffee really built this country. So very pro on nicotine. Your problem when you get to stuff like cigarettes or you're actually inhaling it is the tobacco leaves that are ground up and used as filler. Typically, those are covered in pesticides. So if you're going to smoke cigarettes, smoke an organic cigarette like American Spirits. But nicotine in general, because what it's doing is it's making a man more manly. There's been actual studies about this that it'll take men that are smokers, men that are not smokers, men that are smokers have higher testosterone. And some of that could be because they're guys that are edgy, you know, guys that are the bad boy, the stereotype or whatever. But what cigarettes help you do, like unlike weed, like weed takes a man and it makes him sit on the couch and just destroy a Domino's meat lover pizza. That's not what God created men to be. But then you take a drug and you say, this helps a man not eat so much. It helps him focus. It helps him stay healthy. Well, that's great. Those are the things God made me to be. And so will nicotine literally just developing an addiction, you know, change your facial and your jaw and your bone structure? I don't necessarily think so. It'd definitely be part of a lifestyle that's more focused on, you know, caring for your body, being active, being healthy. Certainly fits in as a part there. And then I would say on the opposite side, you know, the guy that's like, oh, I don't smoke. I wouldn't even try that. Well, you might have someone that's a little bit timid, not risk-taking. Like testosterone drives men to take risks. And so you have a guy that's like, I don't do any of that. I'm scared I would get addicted. I'm scared I would this. There's valid reasons. Sometimes I understand that. But baby, bro, you need to branch out and try some new things in life.
Yeah, it's funny. Speaking of trying new things in life, don't do this. But, you know, I was talking to some people at church yesterday. And apparently, you know, I know more people who have tried DMT than I would have thought.
Oof. So,
I mean, I that one, they're not into that now, but you know, not sure, everyone has clean homeschooled past and the circle that I run in. So, you know, when you're an adult, you kind of learn how many people have done cocaine, and then I guess, you know, now it's more like you're learning how many people have done DMT.
Which, speaking of spirits, like those things really, I think they blow the hinges off and you're able to access the spirit world. Like that's why they're so gripping. It's funny, like some people have a great experience and other people will be like, those most terrible 6 hours of my life. Yeah, because you saw the universe and its metaphysical properties and beings and spirits that you were not meant to see yet. So. Jeremy Kearns had a question. Maybe he can clarify.
Let's do some questions. I'll do them in order. What are your thoughts? He had two questions. This is the first. I guess he's talking about physiognomy here. You know, any resources? I think he referenced the one thing about beauty being a moral issue.
Yeah, so that's a book by Roger Scruton, Beauty. I think that's just literally the name of it. I have a study saved. I can maybe find it and tweet it out. It's called Attractiveness Matters, and it's a huge compendium of, like, honestly, like people that are more attractive, all these different things that we can measure, like facial symmetry, eye slant. So like eye slanted down versus up, they actually correlate pretty well to like lifetime achievement. Like, let's just be honest, like a woman that's very attractive, a very attractive blonde, like she just has a different life. Like doors are going to open for her.
Easy mode, you know?
She has it on easy mode. So there really are actually studies out there that, yeah, like appearance. Cause like, for example, for a man, like say a man is just in good shape. The thing about that is you can't buy that. Almost anything else in the world that you can buy. But you know what you can't buy? A six pack of 200 pounds. There is one way you get that. Focus, determination, discipline over months at a time. And so even when it comes to business, you know what I'd rather see? A man that has a six pack than a man that's 200 pounds overweight. And it's like, well, this is business. This is money. This is unrelated. No. It's the person. It's all interconnected. Is he going to bring the same lack of self-control, the same indulgence, the same lack of impulse control? Is he going to bring that to the business? Because if so, I don't want that. And then this guy is going to bring in his discipline. He's going to bring in his care for himself, his meticulous tracking over time. He's going to bring that to my business? Yeah, I want that guy. And so, yeah, there's definitely studies out there. Beauty, attractiveness, all of these things, they are correlated, not deterministically. Not as though like I'm attractive, life is going to be handed to me. No, it's not. Or I'm ugly, it's all over for me. No, it's not. But generally speaking, that is the result.
We got Bishop of Railway asking about the Hutterites. They apparently look similar to the Jews. I don't know about this at all. Dress like Jews and live in communistic communities, but are German descent. Any ideas?
So that would be the Ashkenazi Jews emerge in, as far back as we can trace them, modern day Germany, 600s, 800s or so. And so I don't know much about the Hutterites, but if they're of German descent, generally lived in that area, adopted a certain lifestyle, they're probably shaped by a lot of the same environmental factors. There also could be influential individuals, like say a Hasidic Jew, went and lived there. And he set up a community a certain way, like that kind of communistic altruism, like that would be more Talmudic in its origin. And so, you know, it's very possible early on, not as someone that literally is genetically related to all these people, but as a teacher, as an influence, there certainly could have been an influence. Same thing with the environment. Perhaps they shared the same environment, the same context. That's possible reasons they look similar. Wouldn't want to make a deterministic, like, yeah, for sure, that's why. But it could be some of those factors that lend towards the closeness and identity.
All right. This is Jeremy's other question. What role does neuroplasticity play in genetics? So that's like the connection between brain cells, right?
Yeah. So neuroplasticity is the ability of your synapses to make new connections. Can you, you know, for example, take up tap dancing, which is, you know, new balance and sensation and all of that? Like, could you take that up at 35 years old after you've learned a lot of life? So what role does neuroplasticity play in genetics? It plays some. Your ability of your brain to change, if I remember correctly, it is going to be dependent some on genetic factors. The thing with genetics, though, is typically you'll have a lot of your children in your 20s, early to mid-30s. Neuroplasticity becomes more of a question and a problem your 40s, your 50s, your 60s. You're just trying to stay sharp, remember people's names, integrate new information. And so generally speaking, neuroplasticity wouldn't play too much of a role in genetics, just because it's more consideration for later of life.
All right. That was a good question. Anthony asked, thoughts on the connection between criminal justice and eugenics as it relates to eliminating criminal elements from the gene pool. So I guess this is a crime theory that if you just cut off certain people, that would reduce or, you know, crime in the future, or
just a safe middle of the road, easy bump and run question right here. I'll say this: criminality, there are groups, as I've already alluded to, they have higher criminality than others. RJ Rush Jr., the theonomist, right? So you got lots of theonomists today. RJ Rush Jr., the OG theonomist, he said, I'm paraphrasing, but one of the effects of Christendom was the elimination of many defective persons from the gene pool. Just in that, through the application of capital punishment, you take people out of the gene pool that are criminals. Like the Old Testament, incest, rape, murder, disrespecting parents. They killed those people.
Achan and his whole family. Yeah, for instance.
Achan and his whole family, exactly. They didn't exile them. They killed them. And what is that not, if at some level saying there's something in these people, not just that we want them out of the camp, not just we want to be rid of them, not just we want to, you know, keep them from infecting or influencing others. We don't want them having more children. I mean, we see this in Canaan. They go in and you're to kill man, woman, and child. The only exception generally being women that could be brought in and be wives. But there is an interest of the state taking violent criminals and making sure that they don't have 8 kids that are paid for by the welfare system.
So on top of that, Andrew Tate, for instance, wants to be wants to have many kids with many different women. But I actually see, my theory is that, you know, European culture, I would say, is superior, in large part because we had a better commitment to monogamy and we didn't just have a bunch of tards having mass, you know, harems and many children.
Right. They could be fathers. They could be present.
Right. So that's my theory on that, because I think, you know, what Anthony said about, you know, genetics and the criminal justice system can also be reversed, where you have, you know, strong man, evil man having many kids and that corrupting a gene pool. So we also have a question from BJJ wins again.
My man.
He wins a lot, apparently. Do you think millennials could be pulled to the new right, or do you or are they going to be as stubborn as boomers? Is based among Gen Z our only hope? So I'll let you go first, but I have some thoughts on this as well.
Yeah. Here's my take on it. The problem with millennials is that, as bad as things are, typically by virtue of being 30 to 40, most of them generally, they found some type of job and they have a home that, you know, like, it might not be great. They might be stuck there because of the interest rate, but they have a job, they have a home, and they have Netflix. And if they wanted to be married, typically, generally are. They have less incentive to, I think, burn the system down. But you take the average Gen Z white man, and he's like, well, I'm not getting into a good college, which for one impacts my job opportunity. Then my job opportunity, generally speaking, until kind of the pushback against DEI, that's been pretty terrible for a couple of years. My dating options for women, like, we're talking antidepressants, we're talking birth control. My options are not great there. I'm most certainly priced out of the housing market. What does that average young man have to lose? Nothing. He's like, burn the whole system down? Well, it was never going to work for me anyway. And so I think a lot of millennials, for better or for worse, they're going to take a lot to wake up. They're going to take a lot to actually put at risk what it is that they have. But I think in many ways, and there's a number of reasons, tradition, modernity, all of that. But Gen Z, I think one of the reasons they're based is they have nothing to lose. And at some level, I mean, boomers have everything to lose. Gen X is actually pretty good. Gen X has some to lose. Millennials have some to lose. And that's what kind of makes them different from Gen Z.
I would like to add that there's a slight disagreement. I think that these based Gen Zers will be led by millennials. So, I've heard millennials called the hero generation. Like, you know, the cycles of generations would actually make the millennials the generation that will, you know, turn, you know, I forget, there's like a cycle of three generations and then there's 80-year cycles. So, you know, the theory was that the millennials will be the hero generation that will kind of do the leading, whereas the Zoomers will not be the ones that will be in charge.
So, yeah.
And then, you know,
no, that's a great
thing. Some generations just kind of get skipped. Like Gen X is going to get skipped. We will have a millennial president probably in J.D. Vance before we have a Xer president.
Yep.
So.
Yeah, no, that's probably true.
See, do we have any more questions?
Jeremy asked about races improving over time.
Oh.
So Jeremy said this. I guess my question, can races improve over time through neuroplasticity? Can they improve morally quickly? Some seem to assume race is firm and unchanging at times. Yeah, there's definitely kind of the question of how, to what degree can people change? Thomas Sowell, he cites some studies where Black American soldiers went over to France, for instance, at different rates of criminality. And certainly those examples exist. I do think they can change over time. I do think all of the things that can constitute a group of people on average, a big one being IQ, intelligence, religion, violence, morality, they can change, and they can change over time. And honestly, like, some can improve quickly. I mean, you would have a huge improvement if you just took a group of people and you said, no beating your children, fathers stay in the home, and you're breastfeeding, getting good nutrition. Like, that in and of itself at scale would have a huge positive impact on the outcomes of any given race of people. Now, all that being said, to get to the point of equality, right? Are we just, you know, like 50 years away from just, you know, Asians, which are typically some of the highest performers in IQ, just dropping down and Zambia taking the baton? I don't think it's that quick. I think these things take time. You know, God rewards faithfulness to the thousandth generation. So there's kind of a sense of a long-term iniquity, third and fourth. So it does take time, but all in all, I do believe they can change. And what's true today for people in a race does not have to be true. In the negative, as in this bad thing doesn't always have to be true, but also, you know, take heed lest ye fall, that you could be a great people and you could be destroyed through your immorality at a genetic, biological intelligence level.
It's kind of interesting that Mussolini criticized the Italians for being a weak race. And, you know, I guess that was kind of the thought at the time that, you know, some races were stronger than others and Italians were kind of self-deprecating about that. Kind of, you know, I've studied some Mussolini, watched some documentaries on him and stuff.
Yeah.
So, you know, the Italians were once the Romans and
just going
out there. So, and
then the German people, they're so defeated today.
I know.
There's a spiritual component to that too. Ethnic cleansing of World War II.
Tobias's grandmother loved a certain mustache man, and now look at all the other people. Now look at the grandmother. So 3 generations later, now look at them.
Yeah.
Defeated.
Yeah, but if people can be resurrected again, like that's the awesome thing is if their spirit can be crushed, if their soul can be withered away. But they can also be renewed. And how many stories in history have been a small back against the wall people that in God's grace and in his mercy, the tide turned and they became great again. It can happen.
Yeah. If I had to guess, or maybe a nation that has never really risen, but is now, if I had to bet on European nations kind of leading the charge, let's just say Western European nations. I think Hungary's already kind of there, but Ireland, I think they might be the ones to do it.
Yeah.
Either them or the Australians on the Anglosphere. And America, I think we will prevail, but that's just me. But UK, after Calvin Robinson's speech, I'm pretty down on them at the moment. They didn't let it slide, but I think the Irish, it might be their time. They might have a moment.
His speech was sad. For what Britain, the heart of Christendom in many ways, what it's become.
Yeah. So where can people find your stuff and learn more about you?
Yeah. So you can find me on X at Wesley_Todd_. And then live stream 3 days a week, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, 3 p.m. Central with Right Response Ministries. You just find that on X or YouTube.
Yeah. I mean, it's got 124,000 subs.
Small number.
So small number, you can find it.
Yep.
Yeah.
No, absolutely.
You're doing great work over there. If you like Evangelical Dark Web, though, you can subscribe to our channel. It's the least you can do. Helps out those magical YouTube algorithms the most. We also have a patron-like system. I have a book, Winning Not Winsome, 10 Commandments of Spiritual Warfare. And that's really all we got for tonight. So have a blessed night. Stay based. Christ is King. And we will catch you on the next one.
Amen. Thanks for having me on.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.